And if you had a complete scale, you could play them melodically. And it's actually, I've done it before. It's a great song. I'm Bart Hopkin. I'm the guy who runs an organization called Experimental Musical Instruments, which is devoted to interesting and unusual musical instruments of all kind. So for many, many years, Experimental Musical Instruments put out a quarterly journal on the subject of unusual musical instruments, who is building what and how to build them and all that kind of stuff. And I also like to build instruments myself, and I'm happiest if whatever I'm working on now is as different as possible from whatever the last thing I made was, and also as different as possible from things other people have made, which is harder to do than you might think, you know? Had the idea of doing something like this because I knew that I couldn't be the only person that was interested in this stuff, but I didn't know how to connect with people that were, and I was curious, and so I put together this little 16-page thing and managed to get a very small number of people to subscribe to the first issue, and it grew from there. It didn't grow huge, but it at least became self-sustaining from there. And then ideas where I was just living in a world of wonderful instrument-making ideas. I mean, everybody who had a cool idea, if I was doing my job, sooner or later, I would become aware of it, or it would come across my desk, and it even started just arriving in the mail, kind of, you know. Like, there's a guy named Pierre Bastien who does these wonderful things where he makes things sort of out of the equivalent of Tinker Toys and puts little electric motors on them. And they make these slightly crude, slightly imperfect sounds, and then he improvises on conventional instruments like baritone horn over them. And somehow there's something so very moving to me about these clumsy things struggling along and playing these really patterns that aren't quite right but sound so wonderful. I don't know why that came to mind, of all the things that might have come to mind. Pretty sounds tend to be, a lot of the time pretty sounds tend to be territory that's well explored, obviously. And so it's a wonderful challenge to make pretty sounds, but making bizarre sounds is a larger territory to explore. Mm-hmm. Because the sounds don't have to be inharmonic, which means that the overtones can have a wider variety of relationships to the fundamental pitch. I don't want to say, oh, I love doing these kooky sounds and isn't that god awful and all that stuff like that. I want to say it's not all I do.
How much are you dictated by what you think sounds good, and how much do you go by what you think people will enjoy listening to?
That question is one where I probably should go get some therapy on that question. One of the funny things about doing experimental musical instruments is that a very large percentage of the articles that were submitted to me were people tending in an avant-garde direction, whereas I was thinking, well, this can be good for school teachers who want to work with their children, this can be good for hobbyists, this can be good for, and I wasn't thinking in that direction. I do tend to want to do stuff that people will understand. It's a keyboard instrument that has copper chimes, all tuned to the same note plus octave, and in fact deliberately slightly detuned. And so when you play the key, if you play it with a slow tremolo, you get this continuous tone, but it's made up of a million glittery tones all kind of piled up on each other. It's a very pretty sound. I managed to convince my department to let me do an independent study. And at that time, Charles Seeger was visiting, important early ethnomusicologist, the father of Pete Seeger. And he was way well on in years at that time, and almost deaf, actually. And somehow I convinced him to be the faculty, whatever they called it at that time, faculty advisor for this independent study. And so I'd go, like, every so often, every few weeks, go into his office and sit around and tell him what I was doing. And really, this guy was totally uninterested. This you know, world-leading ethnomusicologist had no interest whatsoever in what I was doing. And then he gave me, you know, a B-plus or something when it was all done, and I'm sure he didn't even remember who I was. So that, you know, yeah, there it was. So really, one of the reasons why I started experimental musical instruments is I said, there's got to be a world here, because this idea that it would be fun to make an instrument different from other instruments, that's an obvious idea. Other people, I'm sure, are doing great things with this idea, but I haven't found them. And I really hadn't. I really hadn't made any connection. And I'd wondered, and I'd asked people, and I'd gone to Charles Seeger and said, you know, I'm trying to create a kind of organology that is creative rather than just studying, academic, you know. And this idea totally didn't interest him, and he didn't know anybody else who was doing it, or if he did, he didn't tell, you know. So, I didn't have any context, and so that's why I started experimental musical instruments. So at least that was one of the reasons I told myself.
What was your project for him?
I ended up writing a paper in which I put forth the idea. I think it was called Creative Organology. Creative Organology. And so I wrote this whole paper, I wish I still had that paper. I wonder what I said. But it was putting forth this idea that there is a form of creative endeavor here, namely designing musical instruments and seeing what kind of music, I'll just say that, what kind of music they implied, what kind of music would arise from these instruments. If you create instruments, they have in them potential to make some kind of music, and it might not be music like you've heard before. It's like devising a new mathematical space or something. So I wrote a paper putting forth that idea, and I mean, I suppose he must have read it, but...
How many instruments do you think you've made in your career?
Well, if you include all the stupid ones that didn't work, a lot. You know, I probably made about 50 that I've liked enough to really work with them, record with them, sometimes play them in concert, feel happy when I was done making them. You know, there's probably about 50 that are successful in that sense. And then in terms of ones that were less successful, and if I had any brains, I'd just throw them out. You can't imagine.
More than 200?
Probably. I mean, if you include every little piece of tubing where I drilled a bunch of holes in it to see if I could do this, then a lot more than 200. Let's see if anybody's home. What have I forgotten to do? I am very interested in the way the personality of the instrument wants to manifest itself musically, and how that relates to the question of, does the player, or quotes composer, bring an attitude of, I'm going to master this instrument and control it and tell it what to do, versus I'm going to let this instrument take me for a ride.
Would you be if your 20-year-old self could see you now? Would he be happy that you'd made such a living out of creative organology?
Well, you'd have to ask my 20-year-old self.
We'll get on that.
But I mean, no, the idea that paper really did end up being seminal in my life. I think I thought at the time, I think I'm saying something kind of cool here, But I think I would have thought maybe it's probably a fantasy to think that I would carry through with it. Yeah. So I think I might have been surprised that this fantasy actually ended up not being such a fantasy.